Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. Another beautiful day. Well, how's practice period going? Going well?
It's going.
Yeah. You know, the thing about practice period is it's meant to help us. You know, we're not meant to follow a schedule because everyone else is or because someone said to. It really is just an aid to help deepen our practice. So if you feel I'm already off the wagon or I haven't even started yet or what's practice period? it doesn't matter. Just think about how you would like to enter deeply into your life in ways that usually we don't have time for or the energy for or the commitment to do. That's what practice period is really about. It's about entering our life, helping us to live our life more fully, live our life with deeper compassion, and to open up into wisdom. That sense of connectedness that we share with the world. So for this practice period, as I think everyone here knows, we're kind of focusing on the Lotus Sutra as a kind of a vehicle to carry us forward a little bit more into those things I've just mentioned. And at the weekend retreat, was it just last weekend? we opened the Lotus Sutra, introduced it a little bit. And today I'd like to go into a little more depth about the kind of history and the impact of the Lotus Sutra, particularly in East Asia, just to give us a little more context to help us appreciate and understand it a little better. And the reason for this is for most of us who live in the West today, reading and studying the Buddhist text, whether it's the early text like the Pali Canon or whether it's one of these Mahayana sutras, is really very challenging. For most of us have very little knowledge or background understanding of who wrote these things, why they were written, or the kind of cultural situation at the time they were written. And lacking this kind of knowledge, we can easily, I think, be confused and misunderstand. These texts, including the Lotus Sutra, have also been filtered through the process of translation, often several times before they reach us. So, for example, the Lotus Sutra was first written in some form of Prakrit, which it was a part of a group of languages spoken in the area that today that we'd probably recognize as northern India, Afghanistan area. So they're probably written in that, then translated into Sanskrit, and then into Chinese, and then into English, French, and all the other languages that we have the Lotus Sutra in. In fact, I think the first translation of the Lotus Sutra into an English language, I think, was into French, and then from French into English. I think that's how it went, the really first one, done way back, or at least parts of it. Translations are never the same as the originals. They are, just by the nature of the different languages, simply approximations, right? We get close. So, this is something we should just keep in mind, you know, as we read these old texts. And if that wasn't enough, also in this particular tradition of Buddhism, this kind of Zen stream that we're on, this Zen is really famous for giving very little weight to the sutras. As the poem attributed to Bodhidharma, the monk that originally brought this form of practice from, at least according to legend, from India into China, This poem goes like this. A special transmission outside the suttas, not dependent upon words and speech, directly pointing at the mind, see into one's true nature and become a Buddha. In some of the old Zen collections and stories, which probably you've heard at least some of them, we read that the old Zen teachers would belittle the monk or nun that they found studying the sutras. One day, for example, Rinji, who would become a very famous Zen teacher and kind of patriarch of the Rinzai tradition, came upon his teacher, Huangbo, reading a sutra. And he said to his own teacher, "I always used to think that you were a man. Now I see you're just a black bean-eating old priest." I don't think that was a compliment, a black bean-eating old priest. Rinji also wrote later on, or at least this was attributed to him, this sentence about studying the sutras. He said, "The sacred teachings are only lists of ghosts, sheets of paper fit for wiping the pus from your boils." He was pretty descriptive, particularly Rinji. And one more example, and this one is from Zen Master Yaoshan, who's actually in our Soto lineage somewhere. One day, after Yaoshan had finished reading a sutra he was studying a little bit by himself, a monk who saw this came up to him and said, "You're always forbidding people to read the sutras. So why are you reading one now?" And Yaoshan said, "I just wanted to rest my eyes." So the idea, he was probably doing this and didn't want to seem like he was just napping. And yet, despite of all these wonderful little stories, in the Zen temples and monasteries, both in East Asia and, of course, here, the sutras are studied and they are recited in services daily, just like we did now, reciting the Heart Sutra. The words of Bodhidharma and our Zen ancestors don't tell us to disregard the sutras or other religious writings, but not to depend upon them. Don't depend upon the sutras. Chinese Buddhism, particularly during the time of Bodhidharma, this legendary figure who supposedly brought Zen from India into China, Chinese Buddhism during that time was very concerned with sutra study, exegesis, and kind of writing learned commentaries on the sutras to try figure them out, explain them. The Chinese Buddhist world at that time was very academic and scholarly, with almost no emphasis on practice. And that was understandable because Buddhism was still coming in from India and people were still trying to figure it out. And the same thing happened here in North America. When Buddhism, particularly Zen, started to come in, I mean, people were all very interested in, you know, reading the text, and it was kind of an academic approach, and almost nobody practiced until, until Shindo Suzuki, the founder of this particular, bringing this particular form of Buddhism from Japan here, till he arrived. Until then, practice was not emphasized. So anyway, going back to China, the new Zen school that Bodhidharma brought was really a radical departure from that tradition of academic careful study. In the Zen tradition, sutras are studied and recited because they are aids. They are aids to enhance and strengthen practice, and not because they lead us directly to awakening. Study of the sutras and the other religious writings has its place and value, as long as we don't get caught and stop there. Like, oh, see, it's written down here. This is exactly the truth. But But really, when you reflect on particularly our tradition, and why study sutras at all? Why study any kind of religious writing at all? Shouldn't we just sit and meditate and kind of find our own way? And perhaps that would be best. And a few individuals may be able to accomplish that, to actually find their own way to awakening by just by sitting and meditating rigorously. But before we take that route, we should consider, I think, the vitality of the sutras, the vitality of these old religious texts, why they have continued to be passed down from generation to generation for about 2,500 years until they've reached us. We are both similar and different from our ancient ancestors. Each culture, of course, each age has its kind of unique qualities, unique cultures. And with each age, as we get closer to our period of time, of course, we see a growing amount of knowledge about the world. We see different standards of living, material standards of living. Technology advances over time and, of course, shapes us for better and for worse. So we're different, right? We're different. And yet, we share with our ancestors the time-worn questions of sickness, old age, and death, of living with loss, of not getting what we want, of struggling with what is evil, with struggling with trying to figure out what is good, of how to be happy, how to be loving. The sutras, including the Lotus Sutra, may help us. It may help us to kind of illuminate these questions that are part of our shared humanity with our ancestors. The Lotus Sutra will not tell us how to fix our broken relationships or how to solve global warming or change the government. These are not direct solutions. In fact, there are no direct solutions, I think, found in the Lotus Sutra. But it does offer, the Lotus Sutra does offer a view of life, of our human condition, of the nature of the world. And we can draw upon those views to see our concerns and our sufferings in a different and perhaps a very helpful light. The vision of the Lotus Sutra, if for those of you who have read little bits of it, is really grand. And it's not so much a description or a teaching of how things are. It's not so much that as a gate for entering into your own life. And it does this by drawing you into an experience that goes beyond what separates you from others. So, the Lotus Sutra. It's one of the Mahayana sutras and began to be compiled around the first century BCE, before the Common Era, and probably reached its final form around the second century in CE. And scholars aren't sure how the Lotus Sutra came about because the early versions have been lost in time, like almost all of the Mahayana sutras. We don't really know their origins in very great detail. So lost in time, but also because, in part, the ancient and classical peoples of India did not strongly value historical record keeping. They were much more focused on what an event or a text may mean, rather than a detailed list of when and who. So they don't say, well, you know, Sammy wrote the first part, and then Ruth picked it up and wrote then, you know, we don't find any of that kind of detail there in the ancient Indian texts. So probably there were a number of people over several generations responsible for composing, for putting together this Lotus Sutra as we have it today. Scholars speculate that the core text was formed and then other chapters, particularly introduction and chapters towards the end, were added or inserted at later points. Now, this is a little bit technical, but the current idea is that the Lotus Sutra was compiled in three stages. The first nine chapters, or chapters 2 to 9, really, focusing on the one vehicle and skillful means, which we'll talk about in a little, I'll talk about a little bit, but also you'll hear about this in other classes as well. Then chapters 10 to 22, emphasizing bodhisattva conduct, how we should be in the world, which also has the great kind of Bollywood-like scene, to use a phrase Kate introduced the other day, which I think is really great, of this jeweled stupa appearing out of the earth. And then the final chapters deal with specific bodhisattvas. So knowing this, we shouldn't expect the Lotus Sutra to kind of read like a novel. Although it does have very entertaining passages, and I'm going to read you a little bit today. And it has storylines, just like a novel would. And so we shouldn't expect it, because it's compiled differently. And nor is it like a textbook, although it does offer specific teachings about the Buddha Dharma. I think, really, it's more like the Bible, with discrete and what could be almost like standalone chapters, compiled over time, of course, just like the Bible was. Composed by different people, as we know the Bible was. But in the case of the Lotus Sutra, the whole text is woven together with a kind of fiction of the historical Buddha doing most of the speaking at a location in India called Vulture Peak or Eagle Peak, depending on who does the translation. In addition to presenting us various religious teachings, which we'll look at over the coming weeks during this practice period, the Lotus Sutra also had a very important political purpose, which is important for us to know. By the time the Lotus Sutra was being written and compiled, the Buddhist tradition had split into a number of different schools, and each with its own view of what the Buddha had taught, and how one should practice. And there was, of course, kind of great overlap amongst these schools. There were about at least 16 different schools, not too long after the Buddha died, that formed. And then they disappeared, collapsed into one another. So there was kind of a lot of overlap, but there was also some pretty strong disagreements. And one of the main arguments that was kind of raging at the time was over the purpose and the goal of practice. Why do we practice? What's the goal of practice? People were disagreeing about this. And there were two kind of, within these different schools, kind of two main streams that today we talk about as the Mahayana and the Theravada traditions, or northern and southern school sometimes, that's also referred to today. So the Mahayana view, this kind of northern school, extolled the ideal of the bodhisattva, this individual who really strives for the liberation of all, the liberation of all beings. And the Theravada view, or the southern school, held up the goal of personal liberation, as it was sought by the Buddha's disciples or by the Shravakas. And in addition to those two views, there was another one which the Lotus Sutra talks about, the Pratika Buddha ideal, which represented those who kind of want to go off by themselves, live a very solitary life focused on also personal awakening. So kind of, as I mentioned, kind of like hermits going off to the mountain and just, you know, living their life out there. In India, though, I think this is important. In India, these were philosophical views, meaning that The monastics, the people who were practicing and held different views, still lived together. They still practiced together, and often, even though they had different understandings of the teachings of the Buddha. It'd be like a university, right? You've got the professor who's focusing on Kant, and the other professor is Hegel, and the other professor is on, you know, the Greek philosophers. And they all may disagree a little bit, but they're all like in the same department. So I think it's kind of like that. So you have these different views, these different understandings. And the Lotus Sutra attempts to reconcile these views with the teaching that all three views, or all these three that I just mentioned, or these three vehicles, as it's often referred to, the Shravaka view of, you know, we work together, but we work for our own personal awakening. The Bodhisattva view of, you know, I work for the awakening of everyone. Or the Pratika Buddhas who say, well, I'm going off by myself and going to work on my awakening. That all three of these are just skillful means, leading to the one Buddha vehicle. That there is just one vehicle, one way, and all these are just kind of leading to it. The Lotus Sutra uses that famous parable of the burning house to illustrate this. I talked a little bit about the parable during the weekend retreat, but let me just kind of briefly mention it again. A merchant comes home to find his house on fire, and his sons are inside playing games and oblivious to the danger that they're in. And he calls for them to come out of the house, but they are so engaged in their games that they ignore him. The father thinks of ways to get them out, but realizes each idea he's had will not work, given that there's only one little narrow kind of gateway door into his old and rambling house. So finally, he calls out to the children again, saying that he brought prezzies for them. Three carts, one drawn by a goat, one by a deer, one by an ox. And of course, being very excited by this news of Dad bringing home presents, they run out of the house, much to their father's relief. And he buys for each of them an identical, or almost identical, I guess, very grand, bejeweled cart that's pulled by a large white ox, which is far beyond their expectations of these little carts. Right? So your dad had said, I got you a go-kart, and you come out, you know, all excited, and there's a Miata, right? Bright red Miata for you. So, and then after reading this parable, the Buddha explains that he, like the father, uses skillful means to lead people to the one vehicle. Some people require the teachings of the Shravaka or the early teachings the Buddha gave. Some people require the Bodhisattva teachings, and some people require other teachings. But all the teachings are just skillful means to direct everyone to the one vehicle. Now, what's interesting is the Lotus Sutra repeatedly asserts the supremacy of the one vehicle, but never says what it is. The three different views or vehicles were taught by the Buddha as simply devices, teaching devices, to help the listener understand and practice according to his or to her capacity. As we read the Lotus Sutra, though, it becomes clear that the Bodhisattva path is pretty important. And how that really differs from the one vehicle is not really clear. But at one point, the Lotus Sutra implies that all teachings, maybe even the one vehicle teaching, are just skillful means. I shouldn't say just. They are skillful means, implying perhaps that a description of the ultimate, a description of the transcendent nature of things, is really not possible. It's really just not possible. We can't write it out. So back to the history part for a second. So entering China, the Buddhist teachings, they came in largely through the Silk Road. Is everyone familiar with the Silk Road? Right, the trade routes that went from India to China. So the Lotus Sutra came in that way. It was translated 6 times into Chinese. So it was considered a pretty important text to translate. 3 of these translations still survive today, but the translation by Kumarajiva, who is a very famous translator, is the most popular. And it's Kumarajiva's Chinese translation that was translated into English. I think all the English translations are based on his. In China, the Lotus Sutra became really popular almost right away, as soon as it was translated. Perhaps because of its unusual plot lines, it has, you know, some interesting stories, very vivid imagery, and its very positive messages that it gives. But it also helped to solve a very important question for the Chinese that were trying to figure out this Buddhist tradition at the time. They were trying to figure out how to make order of the many and various texts, Buddhist texts that were being translated into Chinese. Because you can imagine, right? In India, you know, gradually one text comes into being and then the next one. It's kind of a slow progression. But in China, it was like, whoosh, all these different texts from different times and different places being suddenly translated into Chinese. And they're going, well, this one says this one says that one. What comes first? What comes next? Very confusing. The ancient Chinese, unlike the peoples of India, greatly valued historical facts and a very clear history. In fact, if you look at Chinese history, it is the most well-recorded history of any of the peoples of the world. Because they just kept writing, and then they would copy, and it would be just passed down from generation to generation. We know so much more about ancient Chinese history than any other ancient culture because of that. So, they were very excited to get this Lotus Sutra because they found in the Lotus Sutra a key to organizing all the many Buddhist texts. The Lotus Sutra would be at the top and all the other texts were below. Because of the principle, of course, of skillful means. It says right there in the Lotus Sutra, right? Everything is skillful means, and I'm leading everyone to the one vehicle. So that seemed to be the best, the ultimate text. In general, the other texts were seen as a little bit less important because they were seen as skillful means necessary to allow the practitioner to reach the pinnacle of the Buddhist teachings, which was the Lotus Sutra. Because it says in the Lotus Sutra, this is it, right? So the Lotus Sutra was very popular with the scholars in China, but it was also popular with those who have a less scholarly bent, because the Lotus Sutra was relatively easy to understand. And it provided warm encouragement for its practitioners, with its message that everyone will eventually become a Buddha. And if that wasn't enough, it also gives a number of practices that everyone could participate in, rather than, you know, having to follow the Vinaya, you know, become an ordained person. There's lots of practices offered in the Lotus Sutra. Today, there is in China a Buddhist revival happening. And both monastics and lay people in China recite and study the Lotus Sutra. And the Lotus Sutra has also deeply influenced, just to give you an example, the Chinese Buddhist nun named, her full title is Dharma Master, Cheng Yan. And she was the founder and is still head, I believe, of the Tzu Chi Foundation, which is the largest Buddhist charitable foundation in the world. Have you heard of Tsuchi? No? It's in Vancouver, in Canada. Vancouver has a head office. In Canada, there's, I was just checking the information, there's something like 40,000 regular donors to the Tsuchi Foundation, 2,000 or 2,200 volunteers, according to their website. And they do everything from feeding homeless in Vancouver to disaster relief all over the world. Very, very active. And often first on the scene for disaster relief because they have a very well-established network. So, Lotus Sutra influence still today. And just as in China, the Lotus Sutra has always been very popular in Japan, ever since the Buddhist tradition first arrived. In Japan, it was studied and recited, but also a very great emphasis was placed on copying the Lotus Sutra as a religious practice. And throughout the early and the medieval periods of Japanese history, very kind of lavishly produced copies of the Lotus Sutra were commissioned as kind of devotional offerings by the aristocracy so that they could gain kind of religious merit. I'll bring an example, at least a picture of what they look like, because following the kind of Chinese custom, these Lotus Sutras were often painted in gold and silver. So they would make ink out of using gold and silver, and then they would paint using calligraphy, write the Lotus Sutra on paper or silk that was dyed indigo. And so it's very striking, very beautiful. And temples in Japan had many paintings that would depict scenes of the Lotus Sutra, from the parables particularly, the stories, so that even the illiterate became very familiar with the Lotus Sutra stories. In Japan, one particular Buddhist school or Buddhist sect known as the Tendai became the center for Buddhist education from about 800 to 1500. From 800 to 1500. And almost all the great Japanese Buddhist scholars and people who would later become reformers, Buddhist reformers, studied at this particular center just outside Kyoto when they were young, including Dogen. Dogen studied at this Tendai center, this complex of temples. And he was also influenced by the Lotus Sutra, and later we'll talk about the influence of the Lotus on Dogen in an upcoming class. And other Zen teachers were also deeply influenced by the Lotus. Because the Tendai, following its Chinese roots, really held the Lotus as being the most important religious text out of all the Buddhist canon. So, like Dogen and all the other religious reformers in Japan knew the Lotus Sutra really well. I'll give you one more example. One of these reformers was named Nichiren, and he went on to establish another school or denomination of Buddhism in Japan that just focused on the Lotus Sutra. That was it. Nothing else was necessary, he thought. Just focus on the Lotus Sutra. And today, in Japan, there are many religious groups that venerate the Lotus Sutra as their central teaching. Most notable, I think, is the Soka Gakkai, or Soka Gakkai International. Sometimes it's called SGI. It's now one of the largest and leading Buddhist organizations in the world. Also connected with the UN, doing a lot of charitable work. And in Vancouver, there's a very large center on Marine Drive in Canby. And a lot of people practice there. So throughout Japanese history, and including today, the Lotus Sutra has profoundly influenced Japanese Buddhist thought, art, literature, and its ideas have become the basis for many kind of philosophical systems, meditative and ritual practices, and its parables and mythic imagery have inspired countless paintings, dramas, and of course poetry. And most recently, I think, the Lotus Sutra has been read as supporting all kinds of Buddhist social engagement. So it's still, what I'm trying to say here, in a nutshell, maybe I'm going on too long, is that it's still very important in Asian cultures, and very influential. So how do we approach it? How do we read the Lotus Sutra? So I think as you read the Lotus Sutra, or if you read the Lotus Sutra, don't want to assume anything here, for this practice period, you may find aspects of it that will be off-putting. Like, for example, long names, kind of endless new, you know, names of this Bodhisattva, this Buddha, that Buddha. The repetition. There's lots of repetition because originally this was probably an orally composed text. Maybe the grand dramatic scenes will be a little bit off-putting. Or that the Lotus Sutra seems like a preface without a book. It's like, what is the Lotus Sutra? It does have that sense. But I want to remind you that this is not some kind of holy revealed text, like the Bible or Quran or other ones, but it's a skillful means to help us actualize the Dharma within our own lives. It says right in the Lotus Sutra, this it too is a skillful means. And I think few people will really fall in love with the whole Lotus Sutra, but I'm confident, I am really confident that you will find inspiration and insight in the Lotus Sutra if you are willing not to be distracted by what you find for you is disconcerting. I hope the retreat talks that we gave last weekend and the talks for these classes will help to open the Lotus Sutra for all of us. So let me end by mentioning what I think are some of the appealing themes. And what I have found, well, let me say, what I have found as appealing themes and appealing aspects of the Lotus Sutra. And then we'll play with the Lotus Sutra a little bit together. So this is what I think is appealing. That the Buddha is a constant presence as kind of an ever-abiding principle of truth and compassion. The path of the Dharma is inclusive, broad, and offering many skillful views and approaches. That this path of awakening is open and accessible to everyone, and no one is left out. Faith, devotional practice, meditation, pilgrimage, etc., etc. There are many, many paths, all leading to the one vehicle, whatever that is, all leading to awakening. The parables as teachings, helping to turn our attention to the crises of our own human condition. The imagining of the vast scale of the universe and time. And in this, in reading this, kind of somehow transforming personal meaning. Awareness of the vastness of time and space. The great drama and pageantry that we can read in the Lotus Sutra. the optimistic confirmation that we are not alone, but part and deeply woven in with everything else. And finally, and I may be overlapping a little bit here, it's empowering. Empowering because it has the understanding that we are on the path to awakening, that we will all become Buddhas. Now, whether you agree with the Lotus Sutra or not, I don't know if that really matters so much. But I think just to be open to some of these themes and messages can really help to open us up to something larger than our usual view of who and what we are and what this world is about. The Lotus Sutra is so positive. And in that alone, I find it so refreshing. Because maybe it's just me, but sometimes I feel like we live in really dark times. Maybe it's because the election is on. And the Lotus Sutra is like trying to hammer home this message, you know, you're not alone. The world is not out to get you. The world is full of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, all here to help you. The world is here to help and support you. So that's my talk. And we're going to do a little exercise, but I wonder if maybe we should just close the talk first.